I'm constantly traveling with firearms all the time, and I collect firearms too. You know, I'm really interested in them. So I couldn't find, like, I seriously had 20 cases at my house. And one day I was like, this is ridiculous. And they don't usually work with other guns. Like if I have my carbine versus my long gun versus my shotgun, like I always had to have a different bag, and nothing really fit well into a Pelican case. So that's where the idea for the Pinocchio came from. So yeah, it's a rifle case combined with a shooting mat that accepts pretty much any rifle or shotgun, everything from 16-inch ARs all the way out to your 26-inch bolt-action rifles.
And it will fit inside of your hard case.
It nests perfectly into your Pelican.
Yep.
Yep.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash. And this is the Six Ranch Podcast.
In the United States, there are about 15.2 million hunters. That's how many hunting licenses we sell in the country. And they spend around $21 billion per year, which breaks down to an average of $2,800 per hunter. Now, we need to be really smart about how we spend that money. You can't spend it on stuff that's going to break. Otherwise, you have to buy something else again, and you end up costing yourself even more. We also need to be smart about how much weight we carry in our packs, because that's a serious limiting factor. One way to remove about 5 pounds out of your pack without sacrificing your ability to find animals is to get rid of your spotting scope and tripod. Now, there's a time and a place for those things, and I carry both of them a lot. But if I need to go lightweight, I'm going to carry stabilized binoculars. And the best stabilized binoculars I have ever used are from Sig Sauer. They are the Zulu 6, and they just came out with a new pair called the Zulu 6 HDX. I use the 12-power magnification model. They weigh 21.5 ounces. And they have two modes of stabilization. So you throw the lever forward once, and that's going to stabilize the image. If you turn it off and turn it back on again, that's going to stabilize it even more. And I'm not kidding. It is more stable than if you're glassing from a tripod. It is absolutely incredible. You're going to be able to see stuff at just incredible distances and really break it down. Like, you're going to be able to tell the difference between a billy and a nanny mountain goat at a mile. You're going to be able to actually see if there's a kicker coming off that 4x4 muley that just popped up over the hill. They work great at early and last light. They work great at high light. They fit really well in my hands. Like, this was one of the first products that I asked Sig to make when I started working with them. And to no surprise, they were already on it. They were way ahead of me. But this is a really good piece of gear. I highly encourage you look into it. You can go to sigsauer.com. Look for the Zulu 6 HDX. Comes in a few different magnification settings, but the one that I like the best is the 12 power. Check it out. Edgar Guest was born in Birmingham, England in 1881, and his family moved to Detroit, Michigan when he was 10 years old. That next year, his dad lost his job, and Edgar started working as an 11-year-old, doing odd jobs after school. At age 13, he got a job at the Detroit Free Press, where he would work for the next 65 years. This is one of my favorite poems that Edgar wrote. It's called See It Through. When you're up against a trouble, meet it squarely, face to face. Lift your chin and set your shoulders. Plant your feet and take a brace. When it's vain to try to dodge it, do the best that you can do. You may fail, but you may conquer. See it through. Black may be the clouds about you, and your future may seem grim, but don't let your nerve desert you. Keep yourself in fighting trim. If the worst is bound to happen, spite of all that you can do, running from it will not save you. See it through. Even hope may seem but futile when with troubles you're beset, but remember you are facing just what other men have met. You may fail, but fall still fighting. Don't give up whatever you do. Eyes front, head high to the finish. See it through.
Yeah, man. I think one of the interesting things to do when a product is waterproof is to straight up submerge it.
Yep.
So when we go spearfishing tomorrow, we'll take that waterproof rifle bag and throw it in.
Yeah.
take it down to the bottom.
I finally have some sealing tape coming in, so
yeah,
it actually seamed the inside of that stitch line.
Yeah. I got a teepee from our Gully this spring, and I bear hunted with it a couple times and then took it on the early season river trips. And Brad used a waterproof thread. And the teepee comes with some seam sealer, but I decided not to do it. One, because I don't like to. And I also wanted to see what would happen if I didn't. And it didn't leak at all. So I think that waterproof thread made a big difference. It was also interesting, and this is an aside, but one of those trips I had my Kafaro teepee and I had that Argali teepee, and it just rained like crazy. Of course it's going to rain like the last day when you're packing up. So you're packing wet gear and you're going to bring it back and have to hang everything out to dry. Makes everything 10 times longer. But it was interesting how much faster the Argali fabric dried compared to the Kafaro stuff. And that doesn't matter to anybody in the field because they both do a fine job in the field. But back here, you know, that reduced my workload by a day in one regard because one of them was still wet and the other one was dry.
Wow.
But textiles, there's a wide world of them, and we'll get into that. But
yeah.
Tell me about Josh. Like we've been friends for a long time. I think the first time you came out here and hunted with me, was that like 2015?
I think so. It's been a while.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah. Did you grow up in South Korea?
I was born and I grew up there till I was nine.
Till you were nine. I've seen pictures of your folks.
Mm-hmm.
Would you describe them as traditional?
Very traditional, but you know, surprisingly nowadays they're very Americanized.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What does it mean to be traditional South Korean?
I think they're very conservative.
Mm.
They came out of the Korean War, so that's pretty fresh on their minds. Yeah, I mean, for the most part, Korean parents want you to marry a Korean girl and be a lawyer,
yeah,
or a doctor, right? So that's that traditional, you know, education-based success that they're looking for.
Yeah. So how old would they have been during the Korean War?
I think...
kids?
Yeah. Well, no, yeah. I think it was post-Korean War, but okay. Korea was still very, very poor,
right.
Pretty much as poor as the Philippines now, back then. So, yeah, they were... Yeah, my dad grew up hungry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't talk about the Korean War much. You know, it's considered the forgotten war here. And I think, honestly, Desert Storm is largely in that same category. And I was recently talking to some Desert Storm veterans that I had with me on a river trip up Hell's Canyon. And I asked them while we were up there, hey, you know, you guys were both in it. One was Air Cavalry. Another was a Amtraker in the Marines. It's like, do you guys want to do a podcast about this? These are both close friends, people that I admire a lot. And neither of them wanted to. And I just left it alone at that. What's interesting to me about Desert Storm is my generation was alive during that, but we were kids. So it wasn't in our history books at all, right? Because it wasn't old enough. But we were also too young to know what was going on. So we just didn't really learn about it.
Yep.
And it's still considered part of the Gulf War, which has included Iraq and Afghanistan, Syria. So on paper, I've taken part in it, but I don't know anything about it. And I know very little about the Korean War other than the Marines' involvement and, you know, some of those battles.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's a super significant part of history. Not just as a Korean American, but just, you know, as a student of history of, you know, what happens when communism and democracy collide.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a lot of countries that, you know, they're still at war.
Right.
To this day. So yeah, it's Who knows when that will end.
What do you think about this American troop that decided to skip across the other side of 8 Mile?
I think he has no idea what he's in for at this point. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, kudos to him on making that jump and not getting shot, but yeah.
Think he's got any fingernails left?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they're going to be nice to him in the beginning.
Yeah.
And then they'll probably, you know, put him away somewhere where he can be quiet and not cause any problems.
Yeah.
Probably for them.
Gosh, that was a bold move.
Yep.
That was a bold move. I mean, you're either going to get treated like Dennis Rodman or pretty poorly.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're extremely impoverished. There's no food.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, as a normal North Korean, you're starving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there still, and I'm sure there is, but it's nothing that I've really thought about, but in South Korea, do people still have family in North Korea that they don't get to hear from? Like,
yep.
did it divide families and stuff?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, they've had like these family reunion type of activities over the years as like a diplomatic stunt more than anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, if you're on the wrong side when the war ended, like that's where you stayed.
That's crazy. The American Civil War almost could have ended like that.
Yep. And yeah, I mean, Korea is a small country, but, you know, it's very mountainous. So people have their own dialects, their own, you know, famous dishes for food and things like that. So, yeah, it's really interesting that you could be, you know, from up north. And then if you're stuck down south, that's pretty much where you stayed. And after that, you're not going back through the 38th parallel. So
what was that meal that you made when I was visiting this winter?
What did I make?
It was incredible.
Was it something that I caught?
No, I think it was some kind of noodle dish. And
oh, japchae. Okay. Yes. Yep. That's, you know, usually a crowd favorite. It's glass noodles.
Yeah.
With usually beef and mushroom and vegetables. You can probably find it at your favorite Korean restaurant.
We don't have those, you know? Yep.
I brought some stuff to cook you guys. I brought some Dungeness crab and sturgeon that I caught and some Korean spicy red pepper paste.
Ooh, man, you're going to watch me melt. No, that's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm excited to have you up here. So 9 years old, did your whole family move?
Yes. So my dad grew up super poor. His dad died when he was young as well. So he was pretty much the head of the household and he needed to, you know, find ways to make money. And he was from the country, like by the coast. And, you know, he came to Seoul, which is the capital of South Korea, to make money. And he's a hustler. He just survived. And at one point he had the opportunity to become, you know, to win this contract to provide Taekwondo instruction to all the 8th Army guys up in Yongsan.
Yeah.
So he became a businessman, but through martial arts. And he's just a self-made guy. And yeah.
I got to get this right.
Yeah.
Since you're talking about, is Taekwondo the way to say it?
Yeah, Taekwondo.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Have you met my friend Bam?
I know of him through social media.
Okay. So Bam and Britt's daughters are big into Taekwondo, and they were just at Worlds yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So Christy, the oldest one, got a world championship in weapon sparring, a world championship in sword fighting, a world championship in sparring, and a world championship in hand and foot combat.
Congratulations. Wow. That's amazing.
And then the little sister won a world championship in combat sparring. And they're like, I don't know, 9 and 15 years old or something.
Wow.
But absolutely just crushing it.
Yep.
So proud of those girls.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I messed around too much. So, you know, my dad he was in charge of the 8th Army in Seoul, and then he had 3 other gyms. So when I was growing up, we had all the senseis, the teachers that actually like lived with us. And my mom like cooked all the food, fed these guys, and they're like my uncles. And they wanted me to learn Taekwondo, obviously. But when I went there, I fucked around too much. And my dad was like, don't come back.
I bet you minded your manners around those guys.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was pretty wild as a child and I'm still kind of wild. So I get it. But yeah, that's probably my one regret is going back. Like if I would have actually taken that seriously, I would just be at a whole another level, because when you start young, you know, your flexibility, all that stuff just gets developed in a different way.
It's also hard growing up when you're close to something like that.
Yep.
You know, we talked about it on the show last week, but I grew up here very much in a rodeo family, and we raised cattle for rodeos at the time. And it was primarily for team roping. And we had, you know, and we had round pens, and we had horses, and we had an arena. We had the cattle, like all the infrastructure, stuff that somebody who really wanted to get into team roping would just dream of having that kind of opportunity. But because I was so close to it, and I just saw it as work, in a time that I had extra time, I just wanted to be away from it. You know, so I had no interest at all in team roping.
Yep.
And I can rope like in a branding pen, like I'm capable enough. Like if we were to go out and find a rope and dummy and play a game of pig, you know, I could hold my own. But I had an opportunity to team rope at, you know, whatever level I wanted to, and it just wasn't attractive to me.
Yep.
Yeah. And I'm thinking that was much the same for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Looking back, you know, you regret things like that, but also I wouldn't be who I am if I had gone down that path as well. And yeah, I mean, it's taken a lot for me to end up here and, you know, in America, living the American dream. And yeah, man, it's pretty amazing. I just feel super blessed.
Yeah. So where did you move when you guys moved here?
To Chicago.
Really?
Yeah. North side of Chicago in Wilmette. That was like a culture shock and I loved it. I wasn't very studious. I played a lot of sports and, you know, even going to college, I played lacrosse in college. So I was always pretty active and interested in business and culture. And because actually my last name is Wee, and in Korea, there's very few Wees there. And originally, I guess we come from China like many, many generations ago. So I was always kind of interested in China and what's going on there. So, you know, I studied Chinese and yeah, I mean...
Mandarin?
Mandarin.
Yeah. Is that the bigger of the two?
Yeah, Mandarin's... Yeah, it's the official language.
It is.
Yeah.
Do you know what percentage of China speaks Mandarin versus Cantonese?
I would say almost everybody in China speaks Mandarin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's Putonghua, which means it's the common language.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they have 56, I think, different minority groups.
Okay.
But they all speak Mandarin.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Norwegian has something similar.
Oh, really?
So Norway is geographically about the same size as Oregon and has about the same population, about like 4.5 million people. At least that's what it was when I was there. So it's like same. Because they're so broken up by their topography, they had over 2,000 dialects spread out.
That's amazing.
Amongst those people. And they were... Like the dialects within Norwegian are more different than the standard Norwegian is from like Danish or Swedish.
Wow.
So things that we consider to be completely other languages, within Norwegian, there's languages that are even farther spread out. So around 1900, I can't remember exactly when, there was a dude that's like, I've got to fix this. Like we've got to be able to talk to each other. So he traveled the whole country and he took pieces of every dialect and created Nynorsk, which is New Norwegian. And it's like, this is going to be it. But he basically created a language that nobody could understand. And now they have to learn it in school, but largely from just like a historic perspective. And the Norwegian kids there absolutely hated it. Nobody speaks it, right? It's only a written language and it's just spare parts. It's brutal.
That's really interesting. Wow.
So as I was there as a foreign exchange student, not being able to speak Norwegian, I'm having to take math in Norwegian. I'm having to take Spanish in Norwegian.
Like unbelievable.
It was tough. And in addition to that, I would occasionally come across Nynorsk and be like, what is happening? It was so hard. But yeah, language is cool. I think it's interesting how the structure of sentences changes the way that you think.
Yep.
So if you break down an English sentence where we put the verbs and the adjectives and the predicates, mm-hmm. all of that functions in our mind, and that's how we think. That's the order that we think in. And the way that we go through numbers is really difficult. Like, I've heard that in Chinese, the way numbers are spoken and written makes a lot more sense and makes math more accessible. Whereas we have silly words like 11, 12, 13, like it doesn't make any sense. Like that should be like 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 3. So it's something that you'll never, ever realize until you learn a second language, how much your mother language is weird and how much it controls the way that you think.
Yeah. I mean, I think each language has, you know, its own spirit. Because the things that we choose to turn into words, it's usually something that's kind of significant and depends on your environment. And, you know, I think, you know, when I speak Korean or English or Chinese, it's, it's a complete different feel.
Hawaiian doesn't have an S.
You know, that's like probably my favorite type of English is when you're in Maui and all the brothers are talking to you and you can kind of get what they're saying, but, you know, it's like a 60% comprehension. But no, I love those guys over there. And
the word buckaroo comes from the Spanish vaquero. What you call a cowboy in Hawaii is a paniolo. And that kind of has the same origin because the first cowboys there were Spanish, but they couldn't say Espanol, and it got kind of butchered up until it was paniolo.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
So buckaroos and paniolos are just products of us not understanding how to speak another language. Pretty cool. Okay, so you moved to Chicago. How do you feel about the pizza there?
So Lou Malnati's pizza is my favorite. If you're from the North Shore, we grew up eating that. It's probably the unhealthiest food you can eat. It's literally just cheese, like lots of cheese, probably about an inch. But yeah, I mean, like if you eat one, you get sleepy.
You're not holding a slice of deep dish.
No.
That's not the way it works.
No. From where I come from, like, we're really fans of this restaurant called Sarkey's. It's like a little sandwich. It's a breakfast sandwich. That's what we kind of go for all the time. So when I go back home, that's what I eat. But yeah, the pizza, everybody asks about that.
No, it's all basic. Good.
You got to try it.
I mean, I don't know. I don't really know what to ask about Chicago besides like wind, gang violence, and pizza.
Yeah, and that's like the really interesting thing. You know, I work in the gun industry, and when I go home, or like, you know, when I visited my parents or my friends, it's like, man, it's crazy over there.
Is it?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to be able to carry in downtown, but you know, due to the circumstances, you can't. And I mean, constitutional carry needs to happen.
Do you think it would help?
Yeah, absolutely.
Would there be a period where you think crime got worse?
It's hard to say because, you know, I grew up in the suburbs, so I was kind of sheltered from that. But yeah, I mean, growing up and then figuring out all, and Chicago's so, you know, like each area is so different. You have some of the most dangerous areas and then you have some of the safest areas. You know, there's like so many other communities in between that. I mean, for me, I would definitely, if I was south side of Chicago, like I've been there, and you just don't know the shady individuals that walk around those streets.
Yeah, I got laid over there for a couple days on my way back from a trip to the Bahamas. And, you know, all I knew about Chicago was what I see in the news and like reading old literature. And I was afraid to leave my hotel room. And I really regret that now. Like I had a couple days in a new place. I should have got out and looked around, but I didn't know where I could go and be safe. And, you know, I try to be compassionate about people from town that have that same feeling about wilderness. You know, they look at a wilderness or a forested area and they think, man, it's not going to be safe in there.
And then there's the hippies that are backcountry without even a pocket knife, you know?
Sure.
There's those guys out there. I mean, it's what you make of it at the end of the day.
Yeah. And for me, the wilderness is a very, very safe place, but I also know how it works.
Yeah.
And I think for, you know, residents of Chicago, when, like, they know where they can be and when they can be there. And, you know, that it's as safe as sleeping in their own bed. Mm-hmm. So I think about that, and I think about what a sissy I was, and if I see somebody that's like afraid to go out into the woods, I try to have that same compassion for them that I hope that they would have had for me, and be like, well, this is how you do it, and it's going to be okay, and you should, because it would have been cool to go out and experience a great breakfast sandwich, mm-hmm. or you know, an iconic slice of pizza.
Yep.
Do you call them slices still?
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
It's just a beast of a pizza.
If you ever get it with extra cheese and sausage. Okay. Lou Malnati's, they have locations all over the spot, all over the place now. It was in like Scottsdale, Arizona, and they had one, so I had to stop by and get it. Yeah.
Nice. Cool. So then did you go to college after high school?
I did. I went to Wittenberg College or Wittenberg University in Springfield, Ohio.
Okay. How was that?
It was good. It was kind of small. I went to a pretty big high school, and you know, we had a lot of fun in high school too. So going into college, it was kind of underwhelming, which made me want to study abroad.
Yeah.
Which I did.
Okay. What did you do?
I had a couple of really unique opportunities. One of my sister's friends' dads, he actually graduated from Harvard. He started this company that was a really high-end travel company, you know, aimed at that 1% traveler that wants to experience something new. And one of them was to have these tours to North Korea. Mm-hmm. It's called Arirang Festival.
Okay.
And it's where they have the world's biggest screen.
Yeah.
You know, they have, I think it's like, I forget what they said. It's like 50,000 or 100,000 people with color posters.
Okay.
And then it's synchronized. Yeah. And then it's a moving picture with these cardboard, because these people are doing choreographed things for VIPs and their national holidays.
Crazy.
Yep.
The training that would be required for that to get pulled off.
It looks like a TV. It looks like a giant LED screen. It's hilarious.
You get 50,000 people on the same sheet of music.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's some tough training.
Yeah. So he wanted me to work for him because he knew that, you know, I studied in China a little bit, and I spoke both languages, and he needed to bring in American tourists. Unfortunately, it got canceled that year. Mm. They had a huge flood. And because of that, I was already in China with, you know, some cash that I saved during the summer. And then I was like, I want to go travel.
Yeah.
So, you know, took a 6-month backpacking trip through Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand. And, you know, that I've always just been into that sense of adventure and just, you know, maybe some of the best days of my life.
Yeah. You're really well traveled. You continue to travel quite a bit.
I love to travel. And yeah, I mean, like the other day I was just like at the lake looking at these ospreys and just thinking like, hey, they have to fly to eat.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times when you travel, like, you know, it just opens your eyes to new things, and hopefully it brings you new opportunities too.
I've been told that our osprey winter in Brazil.
They do.
That's a long ways, dude.
Yeah. They're probably my favorite bird. I live in Bend, Oregon right now, and we have all these posts everywhere in town, and also at our lakes and rivers, and you can see a really healthy population of osprey there.
Cool.
Yeah, man.
That's awesome. Okay. So are we getting towards Lionheart yet?
Yeah. So went to college, played a bunch of music. I was a musician ever since I was little.
What do you play?
I play guitar, mandolin, violin. Violin was my main instrument growing up.
Violin is the most beautiful of all instruments.
My girlfriend loves the violin.
Yeah.
It's also the hardest to play.
I've spent about 30 seconds at it, and that was enough for me to realize that I should leave it to the professionals.
Well, I mean, it's very intuitive. You don't really think about it. You know, with the guitar, you have frets, and you can kind of system it. You know, you can figure out how it works, like, hey, it needs to be in this spot. But with the violin, there's no frets, so it's a completely open canvas, and just the smallest, you know, wrong area, and yeah, there goes your note.
Yeah. Huh. Well, I think violin music is really beautiful. There's some good fiddle players here, and I'm told that, you know, the difference between a fiddle and a violin is, one, how you play it, and two, whether you carry it in a case or a bag.
Yep.
But there is a little bit of a tradition with fiddle players here, and there's some really excellent ones. But it is beautiful music. It It's never clunky, you know?
No, and I think it's a great instrument for kids. I think it really helps develop their brain functions in kind of a different way than, let's say, if you didn't.
Einstein played the violin.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of virtuosos that, you know, play the violin. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That probably explains why it didn't click with me.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't stick with it too long, you know, when high school came around. I didn't want to play orchestra anymore. Yeah. I wanted to play football and wrestle and play lacrosse. So, yeah, that kind of, you know, that part kind of disappeared. But now, you know, yeah, I'm finding myself thinking of making, like, violin-shaped, you know, rifle cases and things like that, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
You know, every little thing that you do kind of ends up...
It comes back.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah,
it really does.
It comes back. Okay, so Lionheart.
So Lionheart, so after college, I tried to do the music thing. It didn't, you know, we weren't really going anywhere.
Yeah.
And my partner, like, he wanted to stay in Ohio because we were, this is post-college.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I'm going to go to LA because not only is the is it the music's capital of the world, there's the biggest population of overseas Koreans in that LA, Orange County area. And also it's the world, you know, the country's busiest port.
Mm.
That's where a lot of import-export activity happens. So I went to LA. I worked at State Farm for a couple of months. It wasn't really my gig. So I found out about this program called OKTA. It's called OKTA, Overseas Korean Traders Association. So it takes people like me that are, you know, 1.5 or second generation Koreans that speak Korean as well as English, understand both cultures. And because the Korean economy is so dependent on exports, they need people like myself to come back and sell stuff that they make. So they, I apply for this program. They fly you out for a week. They teach you the basics of trade. And, you know, you fly back and hopefully you do something involved in business.
Wow.
But anyways, I got selected for that, went there, and you know, I've always been really interested in firearms, you know, especially the historical aspect of firearms and World War II weapons, especially the Garand, my favorite rifle of all time, because without that Garand and without the M1 carbines, like, Korea would be red. It wouldn't be where it is, and a lot of GIs gave their lives, and a lot of NATO allied troops gave their lives, and obviously a lot of Koreans died during that war, but it just really showed that without firearms and technology, that your way of life could end if you can't protect what you have.
Right.
So I've always been really interested in firearms, so I found out about these Daewoo guns, K1s and K2s, and DP-51 made by Daewoo Precision Industries. This company was built in the 70s, or this factory was built in the 70s. So during the Vietnam War, South Korea sent troops to Vietnam, and in return, the U.S. provided military assistance. And one of them was this weapons factory in South Korea. It's a turnkey Colt factory. They have M16A1, TDPs, technical data packages, M60, you name it, the whole Vietnam era weapons, they were set up there. And the story behind this factory, which is really interesting, is that it was built in these valleys on the very southernmost point of Korea and Busan. So the North couldn't bomb these factories because back then they were dumb.
Oh, right.
So the bombs couldn't hit them at certain angles. So
okay.
Supposedly the president back then, he flew around in helicopters, found this spot, sent troops to Vietnam. U.S. is like, hey, here's a Colt factory. So anyways, I became aware of Daewoo and the fact that, you know, in the 80s, Kimber and a couple other importers imported their pistols and rifles. And at first they were like super cheap. They gained popularity because they're really high quality. The K1 and K2 are different than the M16 or AR platforms, but very similar.
Okay.
Same technologies. And that was really well received. And the DP-51 pistol, which has got this unique action. It's got a single action, double action, and then they used to call it triple action. I coined the term double action plus to make it simpler. But when the hammer is back, you can manually push the hammer forward with your finger. And what that does is that it creates the length of a double action trigger pull, with the weight of a single action. So it's a really long but clean and light first trigger or first shot.
Interesting. What's the benefit of that?
Back then, you know, now I'm really into 1911s. Mm-hmm. Like 1911s are my life now. But back then when I was, when I imported that pistol and marketed it and sold that pistol, really the selling point was, hey, the first shot, you know, on a single action gun, maybe you're having, you know, a nervous system response when you're just like, you know, not even thinking of pulling the trigger.
Right.
So it's kind of that like double action safety, but accuracy of a single action. So that was kind of the benefit of that system. And that's what we marketed it. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't show it to you yet, but my Aimrite spear gun mm-hmm. basically has a grip safety.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
Which is so cool.
Yeah.
Because if you have gloves on when you're diving, it's really hard to feel a safety. And a lot of them just have button safeties on the side.
Yeah.
And man, if you spot a fish and you breathe up and you swim down and get there and get that thing in range and pull on the trigger and nothing happens, it's like, what's going on? You know, you don't have time. You're running out of air.
Yep.
So it's really nice to be able to just, anytime that you're grabbing the grip, the gun's ready to go. Anytime that you're not, the gun's safe. Like,
yeah, I mean,
it's a beautiful thing.
People have different opinions about the grip safety. Personally, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah. Who doesn't like it?
People that didn't like Springfield XDs,
okay.
But they probably just didn't like the XD or,
yeah.
I don't know, a lot of diehard competition shooters will oftentimes pin their grip safety to their frame. Mm. So they just want that thumb safety
yep.
or the manual safety to be the only thing, and they don't want anything to potentially stop them from firing that shot.
Gotcha.
So, you know, sometimes people pin it, and I think now there's companies that are offering it like from factory pinned. But yeah, I'm a huge fan, especially when you have, you know, a 2.5 pound single action trigger.
Yeah.
It's just nice to know that you're not going to shoot yourself or something else.
Totally. Yeah. I don't like slide safeties. I think that safeties do have their time and place, and it can be something that's personal to the shooter. And I'm never going to tell somebody that likes one that they shouldn't.
Yep.
I just don't like them myself. And I feel safer with a gun that cannot be put on safety than I do with one that can.
But what about on your AR?
Yeah. So with rifles, it's going to be a different deal.
Yeah.
You know, because
it's not living in a holster.
It's not living in a holster. There's things that can touch the trigger.
Yep.
And you know, I do want to have a round chambered anytime that it needs to be, which
yep.
could be for a really prolonged amount of time.
Yep.
When I was in Africa, the PH that I was hunting with carried a Winchester Pre-64 Model 70 375 H&H, which is just a classic African rifle. And he would walk around with a round chambered, but he would raise his bolt, pull the trigger, and lower the bolt. So he had a round chambered, but it wasn't cocked. And
yep.
he'd been carrying this gun for 30 years and didn't use the safety at all. So when he needed to shoot, all he had to do was raise and lower the bolt, and
yeah.
then it would be ready to go. I thought that was really interesting and something that I'd never seen in the States.
Yeah. No, I think this thing about safety, it's been something that I put a lot of thought into, especially the Lionheart pistols, the DP-51 and the LH-9, and I forget what they call the newest models. But, you know, if you look at the 1911, the really great thing about that safety is that when you pull it out of the holster and maintain or, you know, start forming your grip, it's pretty instinctive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also very easy to put back on safe.
Yeah.
The Lionheart pistols, in my opinion, I love everything about them. I have the very first ones. And you can actually take the safeties out, believe it or not, and the gun will function. But it's pointed the wrong way.
Oh, really?
So imagine the 1911 paddles are pointing this way. The Lionheart's paddles are pointing the other way. So it's pretty easy to take off safe, but to put back on is a lot of effort.
A little tricky. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, the 1911, yeah, man, it's just like the more new things come out, the more I kind of look back into history and why these platforms were used, and you can really appreciate the design. And yeah, the safety, in my opinion, on the 1911 is probably the best designed handgun safety system of all time.
Now, this company that you're talking about, is it Daewoo?
So Daewoo was the guys that made the DP51. I went over there. I updated it. We Cerakoted it, put Novak sights on, added front serrations, changed the grips, and just did a couple, you know, cosmetic things to it. So that gun is the South Korean service pistol. It still is. It's called the K5.
Yep.
And unfortunately, I exited Lionheart. I had some issues with my partners, and I ended up finding about this other company when I was over there, because I was over there all the time on business, and I found this company called Dasan Machineries.
Dasan?
Dasan, D-A-S-A-N.
Okay.
Yeah, Dasan Machineries. And
this is a company that everybody should know about but doesn't.
Yeah, nobody really knows about them unless you're in the firearms industry on the manufacturing side.
Yeah.
But Dasan has been around for 25 years, started making pistol barrels. We specialize in the 1911. Anyways, I found out that, you know, when I kept going to the Daewoo factory, that they weren't really making any of the pistol parts. They were like doing the final assembly, shooting, you know, testing and all that, but they weren't really machining the pistol parts. So I was like, where are you guys getting this done? They're like, oh, there's this company called Dasan, you know, that, because, you know, Daewoo used to be the South Korean arsenal. Mm-hmm. They're the government that turned private, and the Daewoo group bought it from the government, right? So it became privatized. So even though it's privatized, it's pretty much the arsenal of Korea. So they, you know, they still make the K1, K2, all the K-series. They still supply their military, but they're, you know, they're a government. They're almost, it's a, almost a government arsenal. Mm. But Dasan has always been the smaller guy, private company. He started out making tools for Hyundai Motors. He set up their manufacturing line. So Mr. Kim, the owner, is a brilliant engineer. And he started making pistol barrels. And then now, you know, now fast forward 25 years, we're actually registered as a defense company in South Korea. We manufacture a lot of components for the Korean military. And, you know, we make everything from pistols to rifles to machine guns to sniper rifles. So we,
and don't you make parts for a lot of American gun companies as well?
Yeah, I won't mention it here, but a lot of the major 1911 and 2011 manufacturers, as well as other platforms, Glock OEM type of stuff, we do a ton of.
Yeah, it's interesting as you start to tease that apart a little bit, like who actually made this gun? Well, a lot of people did.
Yep.
You know, which part of it are we talking about? Yeah.
So for us, I mean, we specialize in the slide frame and barrel, and that's really the, you know, the skeletal structure of a gun. Mm-hmm. So, but honestly, for the 1911, we make every part. We're very vertically integrated. Anyway, so I found this company. They were just making parts, and I was like, Mr. Kim, like, you're making all these parts, doing hundreds of thousands of parts a year, and you're not making that much money. I was like, these brands, American brands that are bringing them to the U.S., assembling them, and then selling them are making all the profit. And he was like, you're right. So he took a chance on me, believed in me. And yeah, about, I think about 5-6 years ago, roughly, is when we started doing Complete Firearms. I mean, we're kind of messing with that even before. But yeah, we really started pushing forward on Complete Firearms, and now we have we manufacture Complete Firearms for a lot of brands as well, like turnkey. Like, they don't actually touch anything. We'll manufacture all the parts, we'll assemble, we'll test, we'll shoot. But yeah, now we have about, you know, 300,000 square feet of manufacturing in South Korea, where we make our own buttons, button rifling machines. We do investment casting in-house. We have a huge automotive part of the business that's casting business towards, you know, Hyundai and other big companies. And but really, I would say 70 to 80% of our business is firearms and firearms parts.
Left turn here.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember about your elk hunt when you came out here?
The elk hunt, I'll never forget just going up there, and it happened so fast. I thought it would be more gradual, but, you know, it was just like, you know, get there and wait for a little bit. But when it happened so fast. And I just never had that feeling of such a giant animal because I hunted a fallow deer in Australia, you know, with my partner of this other project that I did. But yeah, an elk is just such an impressive animal, and being there, and I'll never forget eating that heart with you and that ranch family.
Yeah. And Jeremiah and Amy and Madeline.
Yep. And then Madeline was like sitting there just like poking the elk's eyes. And I was just like, wow, she's growing up so different than how I grew up in Chicago or in Korea. You know, we're so removed from that.
You should see her now, dude. She is such a cool little girl.
How old is she?
I'm not sure. I should know. She comes over here with her folks from time to time, and she's just a really independent, smart, like feral child.
Yeah.
You know, she's out there living with animals all the time. And, and I think, you know, that might've been the first dead elk that she ever saw. So as a really little girl, I don't know if she could even really talk yet.
No, she couldn't.
You know, that's when she was starting to learn about wild animals becoming meat. And, you know, from a larger history perspective, we all learned that before we could talk. And now we've sort of lost track of that. So it can be offensive to people now when they see an animal get killed for food. They're fine with meat, most people, but they're not necessarily fine with, you know, knowing what had to happen first.
Yeah, I think if most people realize, like, all the effort that goes into harvesting and cleaning an animal, like, they'd be much more appreciative of what they eat, because everybody, you know, they go hunting with their credit cards.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that was amazing. And, you know, the mom and the dad, like, they explained, like, what had happened. It wasn't just like, hey, go touch the elk in the eyes. They were just like, hey, like, you know, this animal has expired. And... yeah, I mean, that was just such an amazing moment. I'll never forget that with the sunset. And thank you for that, James.
No, thank you. It was fun. It was super fun. And, you know, I could tell, like, you knew your rifle, you knew your gear, you knew those systems, but putting it together in real speed that isn't on a clock. You've got a bunch of unknowns, like... you don't have time to set up. Like, we've got to go. Like, this is happening fast. Like, you know, it changes things. It changes the pace of how you think and how you have to act. And then it all slows way down.
Yeah. And honestly, in that situation, if I didn't have that tripod, I would probably not have connected with that shot.
That was the first time I'd ever seen a Spartan tripod.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shout outs to Rob at Spartan. Yeah. I had one of the early models, and he's a legend, right?
He is such a legend.
Yeah, he's awesome. Yeah, he's the wildest Brit I know. And I think he's going to live to like 200, too.
He might be 200 right now. We don't know. Yeah.
He's got that elvish Viking blood in him.
Yeah. No, he's looked like the same age for as long as I've known him.
No, but that Spartan tripod, and that was at like 550 or 580 with a 300 Win Mag proof research rifle. And I was shocked at how fast that happened. And after that, I was like, I'm definitely carrying a tripod everywhere I go.
Yeah. Yeah. For Western hunting, man, it's so necessary. Like, you just rarely ever get to use a bipod in the wild.
I mean, and even if I would have had a backpack, it wouldn't have cleared enough for me to get a shot. You can't see anything.
Yeah. You're in the grass. For mountain hunts where, you know, you're sneaking up over a ridge and you can get on top of a rock, then bipods become a lot more practical. Or if you're in like very short grass prairie or something like that. But man, most of the time, I think 90% of my shots are taken off of a tripod.
There's a lot of good tripods out there. Get probably the lightest one if you're out hunting. You know, that's reasonably stable. There's always that compromise between weight and stability. But yeah, I mean, I would just take your tripod and make sure you at least go to your range and shoot it out to 500-600, you know?
Yeah. You know, whatever you can shoot 100% of the time on the range, just, you know, divide that by half, and that's what you can shoot when it matters out there in the wild.
I would say so for sure. Yeah. So. And yeah, I was, and that ranging and that communication process between me and you, or you and I during that, was just so fast. And you're like, I think you were like 550, and then I was like thinking, like, you know, thinking of my dope and dialing my scope and all of that. like going back, like if weight wasn't an issue, I think for hunting, like a Christmas type of reticle, like a Tremor 3,
yeah,
could be awesome.
I use Christmas tree reticles on everything.
Yeah.
The only time that burns me, man, is hunting bears close range in low light. Because yep. if you're shooting at low light against a black animal and you've got to zoom down because it's close, those first focal plane Christmas trees get pretty tough to see.
Yep. Yeah, for sure.
In fact, I was bear hunting with one right after I shot a sniper match in Montana. I was bear hunting with Ross from Switchback Outdoors in McCall, Idaho. I'd ridden my motorcycle to Montana, rode it to Idaho. As soon as I got there, like we took off, we went and sat on this bait, and I think it was like a 50-yard shot, and this bear came in at last light. We're just getting massacred by mosquitoes, and I was on 5 power or something, and I looked through it, and I couldn't see my reticle at all. So I was like, okay, well, I know where the reticle is. It's in the middle of the scope. So I just zoomed up until all I could see was the part of the bear. Wow. I wanted to shoot, and just used the middle of my scope to shoot.
That's a hack. That's pretty smart, man.
It's a hack.
Yeah. You know,
it worked. I mean, we got the bear.
That's amazing. No, yeah.
So the next day, I had this bear on the back of my motorcycle. And we'd frozen the hide that night, but it was hot, man. It was a hot day, and I had to make it from McCall to Boise. And this bear started to thaw out when I was on my way to the taxidermist, and one paw like started to like wave in the wind, and there's some little kids in car seats,
oh,
you know, looking
gosh.
At me and like, what in the hell is going
Welcome
on?
Welcome to Idaho.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, not in California anymore.
Nope.
But you know what really brought you out here for that elk hunt was Paladin, and
yes.
and you wanting to bring some awareness of that brand to the hunting community. You know, you're looking for input on ways that it could be improved or implemented. Mm-hmm. It's something that you've always been really honest about, and something that I've always appreciated about you is I can honestly tell you, man, this is a polished gem. It's mm-hmm. just right. Or I can be like, man, this ain't it. Like,
yep.
You know, we got to fix this, and this, and then you'll have something. And you never take that personally, and you're constantly innovating. And you're so forward thinking in the products that you're coming up with within Paladin. To be completely honest, there's some stuff that you make that it takes me years to understand what it's for.
Yep.
And then once I get it, I'm like, oh my gosh, like that's great. Like mm-hmm. now I understand this thing,
yep.
but you're way ahead of me sometimes.
Yeah. And honestly, that spirit comes from Matthew March. He's the founder, rest in peace, Matt.
Yeah.
He was a legend in Australia. The company started in Australia.
Australian military.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. He was in the Australian military, and then, they needed new ways to carry their LAW rocket launchers. And then he came up with this really clever quick release mechanism for the side of their rug packs. Mm-hmm. And when he was hunting in New Zealand, and he was climbing the Southern Alps, he needed his hands free. He needed quick access to his rifle. He needed it to be ultra light, durable. And he came up with this product. We coined it the Apex Modular Rig, or AMR. And, unfortunately Matt's gone now, but, Sean, his best mate, Sean's been with the company from day one, helping design, helping refine, providing that honest, critical feedback. And because they were both military guys, and Aussies are good at breaking shit. Mm-hmm. Like, they're tough on their stuff. And they went through many, many iterations before coming to the original AMR. But anyways, yeah, after he passed away, I really had to focus on, you know, how am I going to carry on this legacy? I'm not a designer. I'm not a product designer. I don't know anything about sewing. I don't know shit. So at that time, I was living in San Francisco for a short period of time. And I literally went, after he passed away, I went and got a sewing machine on Craigslist. And I was like, I better fucking learn how to sew if I'm going to be in this business and actually understand it.
No kidding.
From, you know, the ground level. And at that point, I mean, even now, there's really not that much resources on making gear. Most guys are self-taught, or, you know, they work for huge companies like the Kine or Patagonia or something like that and gain experience. It's very rare for people to kind of get into this soft goods game, you know, without a prior experience.
So that wasn't that long ago that you went from buying a Craigslist sewing machine to now, like, you've got a manufacturing facility in Bend, yep. and you're laser cutting all this crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. And, like, your laser machine is really cool. Mm-hmm. I was mesmerized by that.
Yeah, the laser machine is really cool. The
Full on mouth breathing while I was watching that thing work.
Yeah, I mean, you know, God, James, I waited for like 2 years before I could buy the machine.
Yeah.
I saw that machine, one of the competitors, they had this like shop visit thing. And like, I was doing a 3D tour of their shop and I see this machine. I'm like, what the fuck is this thing?
Yeah.
And it said Autometrics. And I was like, do my research, $170,000. I was like, fuck, I can't afford that. Like, that's a lot.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was like just salivating to acquire this machine. And then my friends at, you know, I contacted Autometrics and I was like, hey, do you have any used machines?
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, life is just really funny and it brings sometimes the right people at the right time. And it brought me to these guys at the last U.S. bag company out of Vancouver, Washington.
Great outfit.
Great outfit. Make amazing gear for linemen as well as, you know, the off-road communities. But anyways, these guys, they gave me a shot and they allowed me to purchase this machine at a fraction of the cost of a new machine. And yeah, I mean, because I'm coming from the firearms industry, I really want things to be repeatable and high quality. When I first started selling, the biggest difficulty I had was cutting things.
Yeah.
Because it's really hard to cut manually, well, and fast.
Yeah.
There's a lot of human error, and unfortunately a lot of the, you know, domestic sew shops, they're like cottage industries, right? It's usually a one or two man operation. And because these machines are so expensive, they're hand cutting everything. And you're going to end up with an inferior product because you're not going to be to exact specifications. Also, the cutting machine now that I have, it actually marks the fabric at the same time as the cutting. So literally we know where to sew these different features on the fabric as it's cutting.
Mm.
Yeah, it's extremely fast, cuts, you know, cuts amazing every time. And
it's more efficient with your material.
It's really efficient with our materials. I mean, we can set the setting between our different parts that are cut, like 1/8 of an inch, 1/16 of an inch, like depending on the material. It cuts differently, so we'll have different tolerances. But yeah, I mean, we have like, we'll cut all week, make, you know, hundreds of bags, and, you know, it fits in like the waste fits into a garbage bag.
Yeah. What's your most popular product now?
I would say that right now it's two things, actually three things. The AMR Heavy, which is our legacy product that we improved, has been really well received. We've done testing in it in New Zealand, has done really well, and I've shipped some units out of that. There's a couple of things that we still want to maybe update on that, but that's our legacy product for, you know, carrying a bow or rifle.
Mm-hmm.
Center of body, doesn't bounce. You have, it's an ultralight setup. You have your water and you have some Somalia on your belt to, you know, carry bear spray, pistol, first aid type of stuff. So that sells pretty well. But really what we've been selling a lot of is our concealed carry fanny packs.
Mm.
I think the concealed carry fanny pack market is really big. Everything we make is, if not Barry compliant, like sometimes some buckles, I don't have a choice.
Yeah.
But if we have a choice down to the thread,
yeah,
you know, we get from Filtech, which is a U.S.
Barry compliant means that
everything on the bag is U.S. sourced, all the materials down to the thread. And, you know, our foam, our fabrics, our hardware, everything, you know, mostly it's mil-spec materials.
Yeah.
And honestly, that was one of the hardest things too, was to find these sources that made these components, because they don't really advertise.
Yeah.
You know, they've been serving the military industry for forever. All the big boys know who they are, and they don't really have the best website. They don't really even pop up when you Google them.
Right.
Yeah, so that's been a difficult thing. But yeah, I mean, we really take pride in ourselves that we use all U.S. materials. And
you know, I think my favorite thing is the Pinocchio bag.
The Pinocchio, that's also a great seller. And that came out of use because, you know, my quote-unquote daytime job is product development, sales and marketing of Alpha Foxtrot, which is Dasan's complete firearms brand that we launched.
Mm-hmm.
That's been my primary focus. But because of that job, I I'm constantly traveling with firearms all the time, and I collect firearms too. You know, I'm really interested in them. So I couldn't find, like, I seriously had 20 cases at my house. And one day I was like, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And they don't usually work with other guns. Like, if I have my carbine versus my long gun versus my shotgun, like, I always had to have a different bag, and nothing really fit well into a Pelican case. So that's where the idea for the Pinocchio came from. So yeah, it's a rifle case combined with a shooting mat that accepts pretty much any rifle or shotgun, everything from 16-inch ARs all the way out to your 26-inch bolt-action rifles.
And it will fit inside of your hard case.
That's perfectly into your Pelican.
Yep.
Yep.
So, like, when I went to Texas in December, I put my rifle inside the Pinocchio. I put all of that inside my hard case. Then when we got there, I didn't have to bring my hard case with me everywhere. I could just bring the soft case. And then when we got to the sighting range to shoot, everybody else, you know, flopped down to get prone to shoot their rifles. I, you know, pulled my rifle out. It's living inside of a shooting mat. Everybody else got cactus in them but me. I felt so smug, dude. It was so nice.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, it was awesome. But no, super good piece of gear. And my gun was still zeroed after flying to Texas. And, you know, I fly with rifles a lot. And, dude, baggage handlers, I think, are tough on cases. Hard cases get momentum as they're coming down ramps and they slam into stuff. Your turrets end up hitting the inside of those hard cases a lot. And then you've got really intense vibration while it's traveling on luggage carts and in the belly of the aircraft. It is incredibly rare for me to show up and to have a rifle that's still zeroed.
Yeah.
And usually it's off by an MOA or something like that. And I think that some of that is atmospheric, but I think a lot of it is just the abuse that guns endure when they're traveling. And, you know, giving them a nice soft case to live in inside of a hard case is clutch. And then if you're traveling to a place like Alaska or Africa and you're going to be, you know, maybe you're going to be moving around in a boat or an airplane, something like that, they're going to have you leave your hard case behind. So you need a soft case too.
Yep.
And a lot of soft cases are really bulky. They don't have that extra use. So again, like, that was something that was very forward thinking. It was very functional. It's something that I didn't know that I needed, but now I use all the time.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at every rifle case, pretty much every rifle case that's out there, you put your rifle in, there's two Velcro straps at the front and at the back. And I just hated opening that Velcro and shutting it. And also, depending on what you have on your rifle, like if you have a laser, if you have flashlights, whatever, suppressors or bipods, the other systems didn't really work.
You like cut the foam out once and it looks all pretty.
Yeah.
And then you change scopes or change guns. And it's like, well, this never works again.
Yeah. I mean, really, the Pinocchio was designed to accept any rifle, any configuration, no matter, like, I have a Thunderbeast bipod on my precision rifle. It's a giant bipod. Mm-hmm. It just slips right in that front and then it's good to go. There's no, you know, annoying straps to have to deal with.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's clever. What do you got here? You got some stuff I haven't seen before.
Yeah, so, you know, we really want to, like, most of the cases out there, especially for firearms, are made in China or Vietnam, somewhere, you know, in Asia. They're using usually pretty shitty materials and really shitty foam. So we really take pride in ourselves that we're using the best materials possible. All our cases are using 2-pound closed cell high density foam, doesn't really absorb moisture. It's extremely lightweight, so we can actually get away with thinner foam versus our competitors. So this is just a prototype. I don't have it fully padded yet. It will be padded, but we want to start designing cases around the guns. So this is your SMG bag.
Okay.
Just like a little messenger bag. It'll be padded.
SMG.
Yeah, some machine gun.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, this just looks like a little messenger bag.
Looks like a little messenger bag. I wanted to really get away from the plastic buckles because that's a failure point.
Yeah, I love the G-hooks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you look at the Pinocchio, there's no zippers. There's no plastic hardware to break. Everything is mil-spec, even the zippers, all the G-hooks, are coming from Elbist out in New York. So it's not cheap, but yeah, I mean, we kind of want to, so the goal of Paladin is to cross that gap between the tactical and the outdoor and the EDC or everyday carry type mm-hmm. of markets. We don't really think that there's anybody out there that's making extremely high-end gear, like almost like a Louis Vuitton or Chanel level of product to those consumers that enjoy finer things in life. And yeah. that's really where we want to step into the market and change things. So that's the SMG bag. And then this is the carbine bag in Andrew Bouidman's Poppies of War. It's honestly my favorite pattern right now.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Are there pictures of this stuff on your website?
This one, not yet, but this one, actually, this rifle bag might be... Yeah, there's some interesting developments happening with the company, so we might not release it yet, but I think this is the future of discreet carry. It doesn't scream rifle. It's extremely compact.
And I can fit two cross rifles in that.
You could. Yeah.
I do. On the regular.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's designed to be super discreet. You can fit a fix, like a Q-fix or a cross in here really easily, anything with a folding stock. I can actually fit a Mark 18 or 10.5-inch barrel AR, complete. If it has a folding lower, you can actually even put it with a silencer in the gun or in the case. But yeah, it's really simple, discreet, and it just doesn't look like anything that's been out there. And it's very weather resistant as well.
Would you carry a violin in that bag? Or would it be a fiddle at that point?
So I do want to make guitar cases and violin cases. I think there's definitely a crossover between weapons and guitars. Like, they're both expensive. People want to protect it. And hopefully there's enough musicians and other people that are into 2A and America and freedom that want a really nice case. And yeah, that's kind of what we're after with this case line.
And folks, I know that you're struggling because I can see this stuff and you can't. But I'll take a picture of these bags that Josh has here, and they'll go up on Instagram the same week while you're listening to this show.
Yep.
So, no, it'll be fun. We'll go throw it in the lake tomorrow and see how it goes. But that's an interesting pattern. I've got a goofy relationship with poppies, and poppies have such an interesting tradition within war, right?
So, especially in Australia and New Zealand, and for those guys, Anzac Day is a big day.
It's huge for them. You know, the American Legion sells poppies to fund their stuff here. So, like the Buddy Poppy, you see little red cloth poppies that usually old ladies are selling outside of a grocery store or something. I think a lot of that comes from a poem about Flanders Field. So there's this old nostalgic feeling around poppies for a number of different countries coming from the world wars. But then you move into Afghanistan, and I was operating in poppy country in Helmand province, and the local farmers were being forced by the Taliban to raise poppies. They were doing that to make black tar heroin. And then they're selling that heroin all around the world, a lot of it back to the U.S. So the people that were buying heroin that was coming from these poppies were funding the Taliban, who were extorting these local farmers. And while a field of poppies is aesthetically beautiful, what it represented to me was barbarism. It was exploitation, and it was the funding of warfare that hurt everybody that touched it. And I've never been able to bring myself to accept one of those little buddy poppies from the American Legion since then. I'll give them money, but I don't want their poppy. But seeing this pattern is interesting to me, because hidden in it are some really interesting things. And I'm not even going to describe them, because I would like people to look this up. But this brings it about in a way that makes it accessible in a way that I haven't seen in the last decade, as I've really been kind of thinking about what the poppy is. I don't even like seeing them in ditches around here or people's gardens. But I do like this. I think that this is pretty and it's interesting. I think it's cool. There's lots of levels to this that can be teased apart.
I mean, I'll have to talk to Andrew Bewitteman, who designed this pattern, OT gear, OTT gear. Shout out to Todd for helping me with this fabric. But yeah, there's a lot of design elements in this. I honestly love looking at it.
Yeah.
Always finding new things. And, you know, one of the things that we're doing with the Paladin is not just the military and tactical and SOCOM stuff. We also want to really promote the adventure outdoor lifestyle. And, you know, our company is located in Bend, Oregon. It's an outdoor mecca. We snowboard, we ski, we kayak, we spend a lot of time in the water. We do a lot of mountain biking. So actually our new product that we'll be launching in conjunction with Lone Wolf, these patterns that we're going to be offering, these mountain bike mats, mm-hmm. There's some really cool features, but what I want to talk about is the patterns. When we sell this product, we're actually going to give back to the Semper Fi Fund. And I believe there's one other nonprofit that Drew at Lone Wolf wants us to work with, is that, hey, not only can we promote, you know, adventurous, active outdoor lifestyle for veterans and also Americans,
yeah,
but also, hey, we can commemorate your service, your experiences through that. And for you, maybe it's painful to look at, like you said, a part of you,
but it's complex. And, you know, you didn't know that I had any kind of connection with the Semper Fi Fund, but I do, and I have for a long time. And I'm on Team Semper Fi, and I've done a lot of events with them, both that I've participated in and others that I've hosted and guided. And I was actually just talking with them today about doing a free diving course. And I've been reaching out to some people to try to make that happen. But man, they do so, so much for so many veterans, especially combat wounded veterans. Man, when I got back from Afghanistan, I was sleeping on a mattress on the floor of my apartment. And it was a mattress that I'd bought when I was a sophomore in college. And you know, I had a really bad back injury. The Semper Fi Fund bought me a bed, like, you know, at a time when I couldn't afford it, off my salary. And they bought me this like $3,000 Tempur-Pedic bed because that's one of the biggest things that I needed for recovering. But they do so much stuff for so many people and have continued to, and they're one of my favorite veteran nonprofits, and they really do help a lot of people out. So I'm glad that you picked that one.
Yeah, no, and James, thanks for sharing that story. And yeah, man, I think people really need to vet the nonprofit that you want to give your hard-earned dollars to, but
for sure,
Semper Fi definitely seems to be one of them, and we're happy to support their mission and whatever capacity we can.
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting low on time here, but before we go and kind of transition into you and I just having a fun weekend, where can people learn more about Paladin?
Our website is paladin33.com. Our Instagram is paladin33. Please message us. You can, you know, DM us, contact me through the website.
PALADIN.
Mm-hmm. PALADIN33.com.
Okay. Well, folks, that is in the link in the podcast description, as always, and would love to see you guys support Josh and support this company, and you'll vicariously be supporting veterans and small American manufactured business. Yeah, from a first generation American.
Yeah, man. Thank you guys for all your support. And, you know, honestly, without dollars, there's, you know, it's like going to war without bullets.
Yeah.
We need dollars to make a difference, not only in our lives and our communities, but also in people that serve this country. And I hope everybody gets out there and crushes their day. And yeah, man, let's be good Americans.
Yeah. Amen.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, brother.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for listening. I'm going to keep bringing you these stories from normal people just like you who have done extraordinary things. Everyone is an expert at something, and they have interesting perspectives on life and work.
and the environment and all of the things that we care about. I'm going to keep bringing that to you. And I want to thank you so much for making this show possible. I also want to thank Emily Bratcher for producing this show. She does a great job editing. Really appreciate her. I want to thank John Chatelain. He did the art for the Six Ranch podcast. And Celia, soon to be Harlander, she digitized that so that we can get it out there on the internet for you. Also want to thank Justin Hay for writing this original music and the beautiful whistling that you're listening to right now. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. Please keep listening to the show. Write me a review if you feel like it. And just keep doing your thing, and we'll all learn from this together. It's been fun, and you know, we're just getting started.